second case, which is United States versus George. Mr. Beal.
I think he called your name, so go ahead.
Oh, I didn't hear. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm Dan Hildebrand, court-appointed appellate counsel for Mr. George. In preparing this case, and being notified this morning that I only have 5 minutes, I thought I would just share with the court what I think is the most difficult point here, and that leads to my opponent's citation of the Hooks case and how we deal with it. The law, of course, is quite clear that a prosecutor can't intimidate a witness, and the question in this case is whether or not that occurred. We have Mr. Amin, who was identified as a co-conspirator and referenced in through hearsay testimony during this trial, recanting much of his testimony that had been previously given to the prosecutor, and then defense counsel sought to call Amin to establish that he had recanted some of his testimony against Mr. George, and that went to his credibility. So the hearing comes before Judge Pallmeyer, and Amin's lawyer gets up and says that he's advised his client to take the fifth. And then the prosecutor comes in with this lengthy statement, which appears on page 30 of the appendix of our brief, laying out a scenario of what could possibly happen. And he lists five things: perjury, false statements, obstruction of justice, which I don't think was mentioned, the underlying charges and the issue that relate to the revocation or resentencing based on conduct within the plea agreement. Then the court asks Amin whether he's going to follow his counsel's advice to take the fifth, and he says yes, and then he's excused. Now, the Hooks case, which I think is the leading case in this circuit, is somewhat similar. And the court in that case went ahead and found out that the prosecutor really didn't do anything improper. But there's an important point about the Hooks case, and that is that it was understood on page 801. It said that it was clear that the possibility was unlikely that this witness would be charged because of her age and health, the Hooks case being a tax fraud case. Now, one might...
Unlikely strikes me as being a perfect reason why you'd want to take the fifth.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The fact that a prosecution is unlikely is a perfect reason to take the fifth.
Well,
unlikely implies a possibility, and a possibility is all that's needed.
Well, it seemed to me, though, that if prosecution were likely, there would be a greater tendency to take the fifth. Because then the person...
That's all being all appropriate. If you've got a right to take the fifth, you've got a right whether the odds are overwhelmingly that you're going to be indicted, or they're just slight that you're going to be
indicted. Well, that is a correct statement of the law, Your Honor, but what we have here is, was there intimidation by the prosecutor?
By suggesting that there's a possibility we might proceed?
That's right.
But that possibility exists whether he's articulated or not.
Well, but I think the case law places restraint...
But if the judge says to the prosecutor, what are the odds of this? And he says, slight. He's still got a right to take the fifth.
Well, he has the right to take the fifth, but that's not the issue. The issue is, did what the prosecutors say intimidate Mr. Amin
for
taking the fifth? That's the issue.
I assume he was following his attorney's advice. And if you are the attorney for that witness, what would you tell him?
I would advise him to take the fifth. I think any attorney would, but Your Honor, here's this Mr. Amin sitting in court, and here's these five possibilities, and then his life is going before his eyes, and are you going to take your attorney's advice? Well, you bet. But why is the prosecutor making these statements?
Because he was asked.
because he didn't want Mr. Amin to testify and spoil the case.
Well, I've got the possibility exists as well.
Yes, it does.
But are you suggesting the prosecutor lied to him about the possibility?
No, I'm not saying that he lied, but what I am saying is he should have kept his mouth shut.
But that would be leading the defendant down the primrose path, wouldn't it?
Pardon me?
That would be leading the defendant down the primrose path, because then he might think there was a zero risk of prosecution.
Well, my suggestion really is that it does maybe there was another prosecutor or not see these things or not. His lawyer's going to tell him those things, unless his lawyer is incompetent.
I will tell you this, that if I were Mr. Amin sitting there and having heard what the prosecutor said,
All right.
My time is up. I'm sorry, Your Honors. Thank you for...
Okay, thank you, Mr. Beal. Mr.
Hildebrand?
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Hildebrand. Mr. Beal? Sorry.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to address count 8, which is the conviction for the supposed $15,000 single transaction in the form of a down payment on a 98 Navigator. We submit that the evidence is insufficient for a jury to reasonably find beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed this offense. The government, there are two pieces of evidence. One is a receipt, another is a purportedly corroborating statement. The receipt on its face, and I refer to page 1827 of the record, says that it's a receipt for $9,000. Then on the back of the receipt is a notation, 6,000, and then a dash, and then initials below RH. And that's the totality of that receipt. There's no date on the back of the receipt indicating the 6,000 was, if in fact the 6,000 was money, was paid on the same date. There's no comparison of the ink on the front and the back of the receipt. There's no identification of who RH is, and RH most certainly did not testify. And remember that this has to be a single transaction, so if the 6,000 is from a different date, it wouldn't have been a part of the same transaction. The other piece of evidence is a statement by a witness named Sheldon Bell, who, when asked by the prosecution, said that Mr. Mustafa told me he put down about $15,000. But when asked on cross, on page 1810 of the record, he was asked, when he told you he put down $15,000, did you believe him? The answer was no. And he was then asked what he remembered about this conversation, and he said he couldn't remember anything about the conversation except that he didn't believe that Mr. Mustafa put down $15,000. And so that's the sum total of the evidence that there was a single $15,000 transaction, and we would submit that as a matter of law, that is insufficient for a jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Mustafa engaged in that transaction.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Beal.
Right. Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Getter?
Hey, please, court. Matthew Getter from the United States. As far as Mr. George's argument is concerned regarding the prosecutor's statement as to the potential problems that Mr. Amin might face if he were to testify at trial, I think, as Your Honor pointed out, Mr. Amin was facing a significant risk, or at least some risk, of prosecution based on his previous prior false statements. And whatever the level of that risk was, it was sufficient for Mr. Amin not to take stand to testify. And the district court did not abuse discretion in permitting Mr. Amin to invoke the Fifth Amendment. As far as his argument that the prosecutor somehow tried to threaten Mr. Amin by talking about the possibility of what the consequences would be of him testifying, I believe the court recognizes that the prosecutor's statement came up in the context of a larger colloquy, a rather lengthy colloquy, concerning why Mr. Amin should or should not be able to invoke the Fifth Amendment. And Judge Pallmeyer specifically addressed the prosecutor and said something to the effect of, what do you think? And the prosecutor listed three different reasons why Mr. Amin might not want to take the stand, not just what potential crimes.
I didn't think that's what the prosecutor said. I think what he said was what the possibilities were, not that to keep him taking the stand. The judge says, what do you think? And the answer is, there's a chance he might be indicted.
Yes, you're right, Your Honor. He also, I believe, talked about the problems associated with Mr. Amin taking the Fifth or being called to the stand to take the Fifth, and what the effect would be of Mr. Amin having to invoke his Fifth Amendment right in terms of how it would prejudice Mr. Mustafa. Because on the one hand, the court would be instructing the jury not to infer anything from taking the Fifth. On the other hand,
we didn't let witnesses take the Fifth in front of the jury to create a problem for the defendant.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I understood that the court had the right to prevent the jury from hearing somebody exercising their constitutional rights, whatever the inference might be, for or against.
Right. Well, I think the basis is that an inference cannot be drawn, and that's why the person is not.
I agree with you, but I mean, what's the issue? he didn't raise that as a problem.
Well, it was brought up at the trial court, and I thought
it isn't here. So.
I'll move on. As far as Mr. Mustafa's argument is concerned about the money laundering, you had four pieces of evidence concerning why Mr. Mustafa, why the conviction was, why the evidence was sufficient to permit a conviction. First, you had the whole testimony concerning the whole lead-up to how Mr. Mustafa came into that money. You had testimony from various individuals concerning how Mr. Mustafa took the chip from Mr. Amin's apartment after he was arrested, how he met with certain other people in order to arrange the sale of those chips, how about $45,000 came into Mustafa's possession afterward, and then subsequently he bought this car. As counsel did point out, there were two notations on the receipt. One was $9,000 on the front, the other $6,000 on the back. What's particularly significant is the fact that another witness testified that Mr. Mustafa had given him instructions concerning not to take out more than $10,000 at a time from his bank account because, as he put it, it could be a violation of federal law. What he's referring to is the $10,000 reporting requirement. So Mr. Mustafa clearly was aware of the fact that $10,000 figure was a magic number that he didn't want to meet. That's why and that buttresses the idea that he put $9,000 on the front, $6,000 on the back, and then you combine it with the fact that Mr. Bell, I believe it was, his coworker, testified that he heard him say that he put $15,000 down on the car. And when you throw in the fact that Mr. Mustafa only made reported about $5,000 in income, it leaves a great deal of credence to the fact that Mr. Mustafa did take the proceeds of criminally derived proceeds to buy this car. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Getter. Mr. Beal or Mr. Hildebrand, do you have anything further you'd like to say? Mr. Beal, yes, sir.
The only point I would like to make is that the charge here is that he made a single transaction of $15,000 and not $9,000 at one time and $6,000 at another time. And our contention is that the evidence is insufficient to show that there was a single over $10,000 transaction at one time.
Okay, thanks very much. And Mr. Beal, Milton Hildebrand, you were appointed, were you not? So the court thanks you for your services to your client and the court.